So you're running out of closet space. The good news? You don't need to stop shopping. You just need to start selling with The RealReal. The RealReal is the world's largest and most trusted resource for authenticated luxury resale. Whether it's that mini bag that can't even fit your phone, or those boots you never fully broke in, The RealReal handles everything from photography and copywriting to shipping and pricing. So you can just sit back, get paid, and make room for things that actually feel like you. And with 10,000 plus new arrivals every single day from top designers like Prada, Celine, Louis Vuitton, and Loewe, all for up to 90% off retail, you're bound to find something perfectly on brand to fill that extra closet space with. Plus, right now, you can get an extra $100 to shop when you sell for the first time. Make room for what feels like you. Go to TheRealReal.com to start selling and get your extra $100 to keep shopping at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com. Terms apply.
Hello, friends, and welcome to Turned at a Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and today on the show, the amazing Melissa Oftemar is here. You may know Melissa from Hole. You may know her from her work with the Smashing Pumpkins. You may know her from playing in Tinker before that, but you will definitely know her after this episode from her amazing new book, Even the Good Girls Will Cry, which is coming out next week, if you're listening to this one, this comes out on March 17th. As I said, this thing is a fantastic book. This will definitely be on my year-end list. If you are at all interested in any of the bands Melissa has played in, tongue twister there, any of the bands Melissa has played in, or 90s music, or just 90s culture in general, this thing is indispensable. But if you're like me, and you've got like an interest in, I don't know, Montreal history, like, I make it sound very boring when I described it that way, and I promise you, when you listen to the episode, it gets way more exciting. But she goes into her whole family history, and Melissa's family, her parents, are unbelievably important people in Francophone, French-Canadian culture, and Anglophone, sort of English language culture in Montreal. Like, just, we talk about it in the episode, you're going to hear us go on about this thing. All this to say, grab this book, and if you happen to be in New York City on March 17th, Melissa will be doing a reading as part of her 90s rock memoir tour, Spring 2026. There will be a link to this information in the description below. This book is out on DeCapo, and they're going to be doing this tour, as I said, so they're going to also then be going to Hudson on March 19th. And then in Toronto for 2 days on March 20th to the 21st, then to Chicago on the 24th, Los Angeles on the 28th, and then on the 30th, the prodigal daughter returns to Montreal for a reading there. And then Melissa will be heading to the UK from the 7th to the 10th of April. So if you are in any of those places, and check your local listings, as I say, check the description below, and find out where these dates are going to be in those cities, because once again, pick up the book, get it signed, and read this thing. That's all I got to say on that. Just read this fucking thing. As far as notes for this episode go, we didn't have a lot of time. Melissa had a lot to do, so that's why this one's shorter. Spoiler, it could have gone on way longer. Also, we find our groove. Melissa and I have a debate back and forth in the beginning. You'll hear it, but we find our groove, and this is one of my favorites. Also, I forget the name of this documentary, and I reference it. So the documentary that I've referenced is called Dead City Punks. And it's a documentary that is coming out on, or just came out, I believe, yesterday. And you can find it, hopefully, where you are, local listings type thing. And it's a, great documentary about these sort of outdoor COVID era shows, crazy shows. Like, it looked like something out of Mad Max times, like, RoboCop or something. Like, it was these unbelievably massive outdoor shows with punk bands and hardcore bands playing, and You got to see this thing. So it's called Dead City Punks, and it's a brand new documentary. Look, check your local listings, check where you can find it. And that's it. I don't know if I have too much more to ramble on about right now. This is a good one. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Melissa Auftemar on Turned Out a Punk. Melissa, thank you so much for coming on the show.
I am virtually with you, and I am grateful for your interest in my raw coming of age story.
As I told you off air, a fantastic book, which has given me ample questions to get to. But do you remember the last time we hung out? I don't expect you to, because it was a long time ago.
First of all, give me a city.
It was in Toronto.
Okay.
It remains one of the coolest hangouts I have ever had. It was, you were playing in Toronto, I believe with Hand of Doom, at the Great Hall. Our mutual friend Kevin Drew was with me at a performance from Jim and Mac from Superchunk. And also in town, hanging out with Melanie Kay, was Jello Biafra. And all of us went out for a party, small pea party, especially for someone from Montreal, at Ted's Wrecking Yard, I believe.
Okay, so officially, you're going to have to write my part two of my memoir, because my memoir ends in 2001, and I wrote my entire way too long memoir by memory. Every single room event, something happened after 2001, once I was freed from like the rock god saga of the Nirvana hole. Help, is that I don't remember anything after. Literally the moment I escaped the 90s and I became my own human and lived that amazing night you're describing, which of course I know all these people. I've been in rooms with all these people. I could not write a book about that. I couldn't, whereas I just wrote a book about everything else. And that is funny that I am that first chunk of the 2000s was a blur for me, because as I discover now, you know, some people ask like, why now? I'm like, a quarter of a century is a very healthy, handsome length of time to get some very healthy perspective on things. But I essentially was running as fast as I could from the 90s to be able to like forge a new reality. And that when you met me, I was so fresh off of the explosion of the 90s. It was an explosion for anyone in Gen X, you know, and anyone in the world of culture, music, corporate takeover, digital hijack, all of that happened to everyone. But our generation in music in particular, and then me in the specific time and place I was thrown in, I was just, trying to run as fast as I could to define a new life, because I knew that that decade was going to have defined me more than really anything else other than my own parents. So it was interesting. I'm glad we had fun. I'm glad you remember. And I will probably skip for memoir two. I'm going to skip 2000 to 2010 until I quit music and become a mother, start an art center, and try to like save a little corner of the universe, because the world has gone radically weird and wrong.
Well, I'm going to be speed running to get to that point, and I doubt we're going to get past, I don't know, 96, no, I'm going to say.
You should pick your, well, don't go chronological. I'm right now working on the photo exhibit, all in the photo book, everything you see behind me. And everyone in the photo team I'm talking to, I'm like, do not think chronological. Do not think chronological. Think thematic. Think, what are the highlights of this person's weird experience in the 90s? I know what they are, but you as an outside interviewer, choose your themes, women in rock, addiction, you know, and let's go thematic, because we'll never get past 96. You're right. I will have just photographed the Tibetan Freedom Concert for Spin Magazine, and then we'll have to say goodbye.
Well, I got a theme, Melissa. Don't you worry.
Okay, good.
I got to start it off the way they all start off, which you don't really specifically say in the book, which is, Melissa, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
Well, you're going to be very sad to hear, Mr. Punk, is that I am not into punk. I'm into alternative counterculture. And West Coast punk, United States, seems very like in my East Coaster even when it was happening, I could tell, whoa, the West Coast from LA to Vancouver has like a major punk scene. I remember, like, you know, that was like the American iconic stuff. In my mind, Fugazi and Discord was, I related to it because it was very contained, hyper intellectual reaction to the man, right? And because I come from a political family, because my parents are counterculture pioneers, take, you know, reject everything your parents gave you, make your own. So I'm a counterculture freak, and obviously come from bohemian parents. So I'm much more bohemian than I am punk. I'm much more kind of, I can't say that I have punk in me. I can say I have every alternative version, but I am an incredibly, as you will read in my good girl book, a very non-destructive person. I am peace, love, harmony. What I like about punk for others is the visceral takedown. Courtney is fucking punk. She is the most born and bred punk, even if she relates more to like Echo and the Bunnymen or whatever, but she is breathing, fuck you. I am breathing, I love you. I'm so sorry somebody treated you like that. Can I be your fan? Thank you. How can I help you? Oh my God, you're an abandoned widow. You have a child alone. How can I help? That is not punk. I am like a lover of life. And no, what is punk to you?
Well, I don't know. It's up to you. That's what I love about this show, is it's always up to the listener. Mm-hmm. It always changes.
Right.
I will, obviously it's your story, and you lived it and you know who you are. But I will push back. You do have a lot of involvement with punk rock, starting very early on, when you talk about one of the early bands that you are taken by are teen punk sensations from Montreal, the Gruesomes.
Oh, the Gruesomes?
Yeah.
Well, even that is sort of bohemian, because they're like basically like, you know, that was like, yeah, I guess so. Yeah. In the very early, so the earliest, I would say my early shows in the local scene were, you know, what they call garage band, so the Gruesomes, and ska. So those were the two like first front, like right up to my face, 14 years old. What the fuck is this? This is amazing. These, you know, rascals are just freaking out and, you know, wearing weird clothes and like high energy. I was a huge ska fan. I will say that was like, for me, the big, I didn't give it enough time in my book, because I was so, as soon as the Smiths and the Cure and all of the 80s romanticism found me, I kind of moved on pretty quick from the more high energy skanking and visceral explosion. I went really inner. So my rebellion was way more inner melancholic, which is why when in 1991, I see this brand new band, the Pumpkins, for $1 in front of 20 people, that caught me. And that is not punk. In fact, Billy would be an example of, that's like him channeling like the power of, you know, classic rock meets psychedelic meets, you know, metal. It's much more, that is the visceral scene that captured me once I came out of my very melancholic shell. But yes, in the very, very, very early teens, like an actual baby teenager. But by the time I was 19, I was a convert to melancholy fantasy playing. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting you brought up ska and garage rock, because I'd say that is, that typifies kind of Montreal punk to me.
Yes,
certainly in
very
that era.
Much. I mean, that was the Montreal didn't have much punk. That's what I'm trying to say, is that I watched from the East Coast, No Means No, DOA, like the Descendants, all like every, all the Black Flag. I mean, I heard about punk. I didn't see punk. I loved Fugazi and Discord because I loved the sophistication. I'm a musician. I like sophisticated music. That's why, what set me apart even with the Pumpkins, when I saw them play their first show in Montreal, and the drummer from Godspeed You Black Emperor, who didn't exist at that point, but he was like more of a, like, you know, atmospheric art rock guy, hated them because the Pumpkins seemed like a pompous like metal band in a tiny punk club. And so, but I like musicianship is the thing. That's why I'm not punk. That's why, like, when people ask about Riot Girl, which I don't want to talk about, I don't relate to one thing in there because musically, yeah, do I admire people who are like brash and wild and weird? Sure, but I don't do that and I don't crave that. As someone who I consider very punk and very radical, but it doesn't, it's musically interesting, is Peaches, for example, another Canadian who I worship. I think she is, that is punk energy, especially now in her like vulva recreation, shaved head mania, sexualized bonanza. That's punk. And Courtney is punk. I like weird people who go really weird. But what I love about Peaches, it's actually catchy. I'm not saying that punk, I loved, actually, I did love the Ramones. That is actually true.
Peaches is on the
So
show. Peaches has been here.
I, yeah, she's so
I
cool.
feel like Montreal, like maybe it's the language thing. There is a difference between the scenes that are happening at different times. But there was like the Doughboys and the Nils and the Asexuals. Like
Oh, I was
they.
friends with all them, but that's just like early. That's like calling the Foo Fighters punk. But pop punk is a thing. It became very big in the 90s after the cool, screaming and crying people. Yes, pop punk is definitely not my genre. In fact, it annoys me. So that's an issue. But I'm happy that the kids have it. Like, I'm happy that like people who want to sing along and have anthemic, like, yeah, did like that's cool. Yeah, Montreal, the main, I was more, if I had to pick other than ska and the garage thing, is that the Quebecois, like groovy aardvark, grim skunk. This was like, but that's like prog rock. That's like wizards and shit. And that I like too. I like that. For some reason, the simplification, and when I moved to LA for all those years with the whole, like, Rancid were around and Operation Ivy, I get it all. It just like it was not a past life or a current life for me. It is like a, it's like it's another language that I kind of admire when I look at people from afar and I see like Mohawks and classic punk stuff and I'm so happy it exists, but it doesn't like speak to me. It never has. But I am so psyched that it exists.
Well, one punk rock icon, I guess, that you mentioned in the book that you did see live, and I would love to hear the story about this because you just mentioned it briefly, is Gigi Allen. What was your
Yeah,
experience
well,
with Gigi Allen?
that's also a good point. It's early on there. It's like when I first started exploring clubs and going to shows at like 14 and 15. Oh, well, I also kind of compare him to David Yao, Jesus Lizard, who I love because that's sophisticated music. David Yao is punk as anything, but Jesus Lizard is like amazing music that like I want to be the guitar player, the drummer, and the bass player in that band. But then I look at David Yao and I'm just frozen in shock. But yeah, Gigi Allen, I just saw like in those early days because I was going to every single show I could. And it was, terrifying, but that's a good connector to Courtney is, like you just like she is that level terrifying, or at least was at the time and was not given the credit by all the cool punks. Hey, guess what? This woman is so fucking punk and you're too busy like sucking the cock of the dead husband, which you think are, is Jesus incarnate when really he left this punk broken lady alone. So like, I don't like that she hasn't been given proper punk credibility. Because you know what? It's actually also punk to like want to be successful in her warped way, especially at that time, all of our anti-success thing. She was trying to like get the fuck out there and like punch people in the face in a real way, both destructive and productive for women. So I, yeah, that's a whole other punk question. But Gigi Allen, of course, terrifying and cool. I'm going to show you something. This is a picture in my book. This is the most punk picture I have in my book.
That's amazing. Yeah, Gigi Allen, when John Kastner was on the show, I think he put on Gigi Allen at that appearance and said that he showed up with a brown paper bag full of X-lax, and that was it.
I remember this story actually from John because John was at the same bar I was at during all of my teenage years. Yeah.
That's Buftec, right? Le Buftec?
Yeah. Yeah.
An infamous bar that I'm sure we'll talk about in a second. But one thing that I loved about your book was Like, I think it's really hard for people to really appreciate the kind of like, and you mentioned it, like the media dynasty that you come with your parents from, right? Like your dad was someone that every single person that I've told that you're coming on the podcast has told me a story about knowing your dad.
Yeah, well, he was punk in his own way too. I mean, both my parents are my parent, but again, back to that kind of pioneering, is that they are pioneering 60s punks, and that they're like no religion, no marriage, one night stands, taking down the man, never working for the man, being freelance, making your passion be the gold value of your life, not money, not money. Never, just living in like cheap apartments, and my father barely had furniture when he died, and he was like an elected politician. He just lived like a punk dude for real. Like, and he was like, he's the original. He was, early on, like a beat poet who told poetry for beer. He was just like both my parents, remarkably fearless individuals who wanted to just, make a life based on their own values and their own instincts and opinions, and very outspoken. My father, he was like a best known for basically arguing and challenging people, and best known for pinching people's bums, old people, young people, like just fuck it. Like just poke through and challenge people, get into their space, debate healthily, intelligently, live life radically, way too full, burn candles at all ends, die by the moment my book comes out next week, I will be the age that my father died. This is like my father died young because he burned it all out really quick. And so he's punk.
Oh, absolutely. And I feel like, like there's you touch on this in the book, how it's fated when you join Hole, like when you talk to Courtney and you're like, yeah, it's I guess this is meant to be. And there's this sort of level of, could anyone else have done what you did and come into that nightmare situation at that time and survive? Because the level of everyone's eyes on you. And once again, you talk about this in the book too, and touch on this. It's only comparable to kind of the level of fame that your dad had, and maybe your mom also kind of has in a different section of Montreal. But your dad was, the unofficial mayor of Montreal is a nickname, but he's kind of the king of the Anglophones for a generation.
For sure. And what's so cool about, in terms of Canadians listening, obviously, having the king of the Anglophones being a total French sympathy lover, like fighting for the French rights, like he was such a good diplomatic because he was a man of the people. He believed that all people needed the rights, the nuns, the drug dealers, the inmates. He was just like everyone counts, and he was elected so he could represent all of them. I say it in the book, but it's worth it for a punk focus show, is that, when one of my many like sitting late night at the campaign headquarters waiting to find out if he's going to win. I'm so nervous. I'm so nervous because my father worked so hard, and I've been going door to door, and we're waiting every hour that counts coming in, and me quietly in the shy, Nick, why do you do this? Because I didn't like, why are you doing this to yourself? And he so beautifully and simply, and forever my hero for this, he said, because I don't trust those assholes to do it. And he just knew that people need to be represented. This is ridiculous. These people, power creates corruption and greed. So that's what everything punk is just like, do not enable the power and become hostage of greedy power machines. And that's for me what my parents are about, what I do live, and why I didn't want to join Hole when they asked me, is I don't want to be a rock star. I don't want to be a famous rich rock star. Like, what are you talking about? I want to be a person of great merit and integrity and independence. And yeah, so that's, but yeah, father cool.
Yeah, and I feel like that kind of level of scrutiny, public awareness. Your dad's writing about you all the time, obviously, as well. But like, that's kind of what you're dealing with, it seems like, when you're describing what Hole, obviously, Hole's like a nightmare
Yeah, I
situation.
mean, that was a global versus local stage, but yes, I just scaled up from a similar thing where I would watch My people just watched my father walk down the street. I always have felt these eyes following him, but because he was loved. And that's what's cool about music is that, yes, does it get into a bit of a weird, tripped out? And especially if there's a like misogynist, horrific media world trying to kill the lady, that's a different story that happened with Courtney. But even just on a healthy love with anyone in the public eye, a good politician or a good musician. Is the good stuff is that it's coming from admiration and inspiration, and people are like psyched. My father represents this good stuff. They want to read about it. They want to read him. They want to follow him. And that felt good. My father had a healthy relationship with the public. But so, yes, I very much was, unfortunately, not consciously, but groomed for this position. And yes, I am sure most people would have struggled. And that's what was so interesting about me writing the book is I really went in there to try to like, support the 22-year-old girl who got thrown into this thing, and she did a great job. But for those, when you read the book, those out there is a point where I start losing myself. But the reason I didn't fully lose into myself nor lose myself off the bat was I was hyper aware. Okay, this is fucked up. People are looking at these are just humans, but in this weird fishbowl, they are like more than humans. And then also addiction. My father was an addict. I am highly aware that I'm a daughter of an alcoholic. How does someone like me react when I'm in a room with other people who are addicts? Like, I was perfectly trained for what I was walking into, for better or for worse, because when you get into the age of where I am now, and I mean, it's basically high functioning dysfunction. I can like function in a very, very efficient way with total chaos. And my father, for whatever it's worth, was actually the happiest, nicest drunk I've ever met. Like there was not even like a demon. He actually hid his demons till the minute he died. Like he was a loving, wonderful human who happened to drink too much and smoke till he like got cancer throughout his whole head. I mean, it's like addiction is addiction. He had a nice, gentle addiction that was very, that killed him when he was 54. So that's that. But that's, part of this, like the tipping point of like, yeah, I walked in equipped.
Yeah, and I think, and I'm obviously not going to make this all about your dad. I promise we'll move on. But
Yeah, no problem.
I feel like the moment that happens in Montreal, that kind of cool Montreal period, is thanks to him kind of setting it up. Like Vice doesn't happen without your dad.
Oh, that's interesting to think.
I think that sort of sensibility and that kind of
Well,
like,
that exactly that type of guy who was
yes.
like pushing the envelope politically and media. I mean, my father had a TV show on CBC from 69 to 72 that's beyond ahead of its time. It's Vice TV. It's like full on like reality TV, turn of that decade, counterculture into hippie culture, like so mind-blowingly ahead of its time. And just because he was a strong enough character with media savviness where he's like, hey, CBC, send me a camera and a mic, and I'm just going to go stand on street corners. I'm going to ask people on the street, hey, what are you thinking? And it's like n Vice TV would not exist without that. And to be very honest, a lot of those guys who were my friends and roommates, they all knew my father and they all knew like that. Yes, he did. This is actually a weird side note, but like my friend was at Fashion Week in Paris this week, and the new executive, the head of Harper's Bazaar is a woman journalist from Montreal who grew up reading my columns. And my friend is in a fashion, like at a fashion show and talking about Montreal. And she's like, oh my God, Nick Offenbach changed my life. This is like the head of Harper's Bazaar, a woman in her like 40s. And my friend called me from Paris. She's like, wait a second. I don't understand. How did your father have impact on like a lady who's in New York, huge PR now? I mean, media. I'm like, I don't know. I mean, yes, that was a radical media moment and style. And people like my father paved the way, just like my mother paved the way for feminist, for like revolution number three, which is what me and Courtney and Hole, we were continuing on her radical pioneering feminist independence of no man is going to define me. I'm just going to be my own woman and I'm going to do whatever I need and I'm never going to rely on a man to do it. So, yes, they both prepped me hardcore to be the bass player in Hole, just what they always hoped for me.
So you're running out of closet space. The good news? You don't need to stop shopping. You just need to start selling with The RealReal. The RealReal is the world's largest and most trusted resource for authenticated luxury resale. Whether it's that mini bag that can't even fit your phone, or those boots you never fully broke in, The RealReal handles everything from photography and copywriting to shipping and pricing. So you can just sit back, get paid, and make room for things that actually feel like you. And with 10,000 plus new arrivals every single day from top designers like Prada, Celine, Louis Vuitton, and Loewe, all for up to 90% off retail, you're bound to find something perfectly on brand to fill that extra closet space with. Plus, right now, you can get an extra $100 to shop when you sell for the first time. Make room for what feels like you. Go to TheRealReal.com to start selling and get your extra $100 to keep shopping at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com. Terms apply.
Well, your mom's got an order of Canada, right?
Two.
Sorry, not to undercut the second one. I was going to say, like, she was the first female DJ at Chum Radio, I think you say, right?
Yeah.
There's this band, and you're probably the only person I'll ever be able to ask about this. Did she ever tell you about this band, or did you ever hear this band, Haute Chose?
Like a Haute Chose. I remember it from being in Quebec, yeah. But I can't say I remember the song, but I absolutely know the name, yes.
They've got this song on this LP that's like 70s, like pre-punk. But yeah. Like the way the singer's screaming, I'm like, this is proto-punk. Like in the same way the Stooges are proto-punk.
Oh, cool. Quebec is very fucking punk. I mean, what I love about Quebecois spirit, they're rebels. They're absolutely holding rebellion for 200 years against this dumb monarchy people. Like, I'm not that the France didn't have kings and queens too, but, you know, the French did a different thing when they sent the colonizers off, you know, like England and its friggin' crown and its Puritan crazy. You know, very Quebec is so punk. That's why I love, but that's why it's not like I'm like the Sex Pistols and DOA. It's not punk. It's its own revolutionary, weird, so rough around the edges, so no makeup, all cruddy. Everything is so cool and still crusty and weird. I mean, there's tons of punks, of course, in Montreal, but it's not defined by a music genre. It's defined by an attitude and a, you know, I dare say, other than, of course, you know, Vancouver and Victoria had a huge, but I dare say the Montreal punk scene in spirit was much more visceral, I would say. Like, oh my God, Foufoune Électrique, the CBGBs of Canada, where I saw these bands, that place is holding punk alive in Quebec. Like, as it stands, it's like a shopping mall. Like, I don't think that level of punk institution exists anywhere else in Canada. You know, it's just like in the edgiest edge of town still, with like just prostitutes and squats, and it's just still fucked in like a real way. And it's so refreshing. I like brought an entire BBC, like a British film crew there to like show my roots of like, this is punk. It's still alive. Like, you know, that's cool about Montreal. Maybe it is in Toronto too, but I don't know.
It's obviously different. Like, as you say, Toronto the good, and one person who has definitely beat that drum for a very long time. And it kind of blew my mind when you did the Hand of Doom show. I think one of the early Hand of Doom shows with him as a promoter, Dan Burke. And it wasn't until much later that I found out he was kind of one of your dad's unofficial proteges.
I actually didn't really connect that. There were so many guys of that generation that looked up to my, you know, understood. I mean, in the book, I think maybe you might remember, there's like this punk guy I meet in high school, and he was the first one that I kind of understood what my father represented, because I was like a dreamy, trippy music girl. I wasn't reading the newspaper, but like meeting that like Judd Nelson character from The Breakfast Club in my math class, and him like knowing exactly who my father was and approving of this force that I didn't really understand until other people showed it to me. Yeah.
Like I feel like that's the great thing about the book, is that you do kind of like touch on how, you know, your parents, obviously it's like the shadow that looms so large, but like you obviously transcend that so much with your career. But I feel like, and this is kind of I'm jumping around here when I say this, but like, you know, there's when growing up, there wasn't a lot of cool culture from Canada, right? Like we had Avril Lavigne, and I'm talking way before that. I mean, like, but Ryan Adams and Murray, but like you were the first cool person, like a real life Billy Talent from the movie Hardcore Logo. kind of going out there. And then through that, it kind of opened up this whole idea for me that, oh yeah, Quebec's like so much cooler than Toronto.
I mean, whereas I was indoctrinated by that in the 70s by my parents. They were telling me about Toronto versus Montreal a long time ago. It's the New York-Boston rivalry. But what's interesting you say that is I just did a very intensive few days in Montreal for press a couple of weeks ago for the book. And speaking to majority French, like the Francophone world, because the Montreal village of English is so tiny. There's like one newspaper and one radio show, whereas Quebec is like ginormous media, more than the rest of Canada per capita. It's insane. So I spoke all day to, Quebecois publications, and many of them, probably because they're punk Quebecois people, but that looking at the landscape of the 90s alternative music explosion, which, as we know, came out of Seattle, but it's an Anglophone, it's an English-American explosion. So it's not like Quebec would have thought that a French-Canadian like Quebecer would have made it in there, but they kept saying to me on these, and it's sort of, you just hinted at it, but they said, how is it that you're the only one that got out of English Canada in that scene? And I said, was that true? I mean, that's not, I'm like, there's Sloan, there's a, they're like, no, but you got out of Canada into America. I'm like, oh, I see what you mean. Like, they're like, you're the only one. I was like, well, first of all, there wasn't a lot of like grunge alternative rock bands in Montreal. It was quite small actually because of this groovy aardvark ska other world. But yeah, I just sort of started thinking about that because obviously I can't see it from the insider. I'm like already out here on the big global. I do know who my Canadian peers are, and there, I guess there aren't that many, in general. Geddy Lee, I like to consider him a peer only because of the bass and because he became my friend in the last few years. I think that it's a matter of destiny, superpower that I embodied that allowed me to like somehow just be plopped into the Kurt Courtney, like the drama that was that emotional, painful landscape that I was able to somehow navigate, not only keeping myself intact, but also giving a shit. Like, I fucking care about that girl, Frances Bean. I care about these humans that I was thrown into that mix with. I was very upset to see a woman who is Courtney, who comes from nothing, her parents are assholes, she's never had any love, being thrown on stage as a single mother and a widowed with a drug addiction and mental illness, being expected to take care of herself. Who are these monsters that are doing this to this woman? So, I mean, me being there was not just like I'm capable to play the bass lines, which also some people find that mysterious too, because I just started playing really the year before. But so all of that was happening. But mainly the thing that really got me far is that I cared. I care about humans. I am a humanist like my father, who was arrested during the French like independence movements regularly because he was fighting for humanity. He was fighting for these humans to have their rights. That is where my parents' good values propelled me in whole. I was there as a woman for women, and not just the girls in the band and the daughter backstage, but for all the women in the crowd that had nobody representing them and changing the way that women have been categorized in rock music, in the brief history of rock music for a long time, and in the hundreds and thousands of years of women being owned by men. I was there as a female human trying to do good, primarily, and a dual citizen, so I didn't need to get a visa. So I was able to step into the United States of America because of my American mother, who rebelled in the 60s because she told me that America is unacceptable politically, and the tax dollars go to nothing, and the people will go down in flames because their corrupt government is not helping the people of America. So the United States of America was already a problem because my mother told me so. But I had the passport, and I was able to go explore it, and I did, and I'm still here.
I think you're certainly the first one out of that scene in Montreal, and there's a bunch of people kind of in your wake. And I think, like you say, like you're trusting this whole Nirvana world and Maelstrom, but I think it's interesting to think of what would have happened if you had stayed in Montreal. and like looking at what happens to all this sort of stuff in the next few years, you know, Vice obviously explodes and that happens. Derek Beckles, you know, involved with Vice, but goes on and does all sorts of crazy other things on his own.
Coolest shit ever. Derek Beckles, one of my favorite. All right, we went to Concordia together. We were in the film and media photo department. Derek was alongside my father in 10,000 ways. Derek was one of those ones who got my father in a way that, you know, I was just happy that this cool, inspiring friend of mine, like, really got my father. Like, I mean, when my father died, Derek was like one of the first doing, like, you know, a goodbye party at post death of Nick at my house, my father's house. I mean, yes, I worship Derek Beckles, highly underrated, a Canadian treasure.
Well, and then also, like you've said it before, Godspeed Black Emperor, then the Arcade Fire. There's like a lot of stuff. Like Montreal goes through this islands, obviously, as well. There's a sort of cool period. So if you're there being this talented musician, what would have happened? Like, how would things be different? Like, where would you be differently?
I probably would have been in art school and making a photo book right now on an art show, which is what I'm doing. I'm finally doing. I mean, I think... I probably would have, like, my solo records that I made in the 2000s were probably what I would have been doing in the 90s, but I just fast forwarded a decade. Maybe I would have even gotten into politics. Who knows? I mean, if I stayed in the tiny town, it's a very good question. You know, there is a moment in the book. Again, we're trying to get people excited to buy this book.
I do a wraparound. Don't worry. I'll hard sell the book.
Not worried. I'm just saying that I'm realizing if I can refer to the story, there's a story in the book where I'm basically being bullied into signing a contract with Hole by Metallica's managers. And there's a great line right there in the book. It's a spoiler, but it's not a spoiler. There's giant metal music managers stuffing this contract in my face. I'm like, I should probably get a lawyer. I've never looked at anything like this. And he says, what are you going to do? Go back to Montreal and be in a band with other Melissas? Like, that was his like logic of like, this is how, like, what are your options? Like, you're going to be in Hole. What are you going to do? Go back to Montreal and just be in a band with a bunch of other Melissas? And literally, I'm like, yes, that's actually a great alternative. It could happen. So I don't know who you think you are to think that my life without this would suck, because it wouldn't. It would actually be great. So, you know, again, that's why Courtney wanted me to join the band, is I didn't want it. I didn't need it. I like life. We will have my own cool shit happen no matter where I am, whether I'm in small town America or small town Canada. I just love being alive and collaborating with weird people and engaging in the long run counterculture question of psychedelic, question everything. Why are we here? What's the reason of existence? All of these things. And then choosing art forms that I love, photography and music, and now writing. And yeah, I would have been fine, but here I am, full circle back to the beginning.
Another great what if moment for me in the book is when you meet Callie DeWitt at that first Hole show in Montreal, and you invite them to stay at your place, and then you're told by your roommate, no, let's there's no way Courtney Love's staying.
No fucking way is that woman staying in my house. Yeah.
What?
But I had never heard of her, where she knew she was a punk rock maniac. Yeah.
What, like, if you think, do you think if they had come and stayed at your house that night, if the opportunity had presented itself a few years later to join this band, would you have been willing to step in? Like, or would that have been something like...
Yeah, interesting. Very interesting. You're right that probably if I had had... I mean, it could have been gone other way, actually. She might have charmed me. Maybe it would have even been... I liked her. And then when she was recommending... But when I was being recommended to her, maybe she would have been like, oh, that's not a mystery. It's not. I was so mysterious because Billy Corgan was recommending this girl in the middle of like nowhere who had never played basically a rock show before. So, I mean, I'd had six shows, but it could have gone the opposite way, where she would have thought, oh, the girl whose couch we slept on? Nah, not mysterious enough. You know, so you're right. That's the point about this book, you know, in terms of me like threading the needle of every tiny little thing that happened, like the beer bottle and the letter to the P.O. box and the time that she didn't sleep at my house. These tiny little things, which is what I want to kind of get people excited about of their own lives, the tiniest thing, and we all know that, but can change the entire course of your life. That is why it's important to be very present and not project big ideas of, I am a person who will go get my diploma and go. Be open to the accidents. Be open to the unknown. My greatest love is the unknown, because something weird will happen and show me something that I don't fucking know. That is being alive and exciting for me. I don't like controlled, planned. Weirdly, I do have quite an organized way, in that I do kind of, I even was able to write an entire book because of the way I kind of package things. But when I'm living life today, I want the accident to happen. The reason I'm kind of late for you is I was like supposed to do this photo book work, but I ran into one of my friends from the 90s and I hadn't talked to her in 6 months. So I walked down the street for 2 hours and then I'm now late for everything. And we cried and we like hugged each other and we're like, remember when you were sleeping on my couch in LA? Like, these are important things, you know. Now I have that bond is stronger. And if she needs help when her mother dies, I will be there. And all of the, you know, this is like, I live for human cool experience.
I live for.
And I had a lot in whole.
No doubt. The book is full of them. And I live for connection. Like, that's my thing. Yeah. It's like how things all fit together, the way these weird pieces. And like, that to me was so incredible about reading your book, because like I grew up like I wanted to show you this is like one of the first bootleg tapes I ever bought. It's like Hole live in Buffalo at the Marquee in 94.
Wow.
Hole's a big band for me, but
oh good.
I think the cool thing about reading the book, outside of the fandom stuff that people get, is all these people that I know that are weirdly connected into my life or fit into my life that are also weirdly intertwined with your life and the connections between these things.
Yeah, of course.
The part of the book that blew my mind to read in print was to see the name of one of the most obscure punk bands, but a very important punk band of all time, Anal Chinook.
Oh my God. How do you, but you really know that? Like, you really, from just your deep dive of, I mean, I was very excited to put it in there because I knew that only like you would know.
Well, Steve Durand, I believe I'm pronouncing the last name
Steve
right.
Durand,
Was in Anal Chinook, right?
With Gavin Cuckoohead.
With Gavin in not so terrible, the blight of punk, the blight of Canada, McGinnis. But also the guy from Godspeed You Black Emperor was in Anal Chinook too.
Ian, was that?
I think so.
Is it? Yeah, I'm pretty sure you're right. I forgot. I actually forgot he was in it, because Gavin and Steve were so intertwined in my grunge estate, the sixplex apartment building we all lived in. So that is funny. I forgot that Ian was in that because he's Ottawa too. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And they, I believe, did a demo. I've seen live photos of them and played in Montreal, played at Sean Scallon's Five Arlington many times. They were part of that scene. But to me, it's like this band that, like, forgotten to the annals of time, but then you look at like all the different people that were in this band and what they went to do. Not so great in some cases, but incredible in other cases. Like the fact that we have the band that rejected the Polaris Prize because it was sponsored by Ford in the same band with the guy that started the Proud Boys.
That is interesting. That should be an article in itself. If I wrote punk article, that I did not connect, because I forgot that Ian was in there. Good. I mean, I mentioned Godspeed in the book. I feel like I did at some point.
Yes, you do.
Yes. Whereas that's a cool connection. Yes. Great. Exactly. That's my favorite shit, is that I also believe a big part of the book is about the visceral, magical, unbottleable power of our generation's young people who are into music. Like, there is a you cannot debate that the zeitgeist, of course, Kurt is at the top, but the zeitgeist that was happening all the way down to the bottom, even into Anal Chinook, that all of these things were very powerful currents of culture shifting, like deep, deep culture shifting, were percolating globally. Like, I know, you know, they're like, Australia has their own version of that. Like, everybody's got It was such a cool moment, but it was also such a, the book has a lot of like celebrating of this magical power, but also grieving, not just that it's gone and that I don't know if that kind of like undercurrent of the underbelly can happen because it's all kind of trapped in this thin layer of internet garbage. I'm not saying that cool shit doesn't happen on the internet. Cool people are on the internet, sure, but it removes the magic underground, alone, percolating, nobody knows until they skyrocket out. Like this whole thing of, anyway, so I for me am aware that a lot of the book has to do with just bringing people on the journey of this underbelly where nobody in their wildest dreams could have imagined that one day Gavin would be, non-directly mentioned at a presidential debate at the most controversial presidential election in the history of probably America. No one could have imagined that. And that kind of mapping I also love. And I am very proud to have had an inside look at the inner workings under there, and then all the way till the book ends in 2001 when I realized that's it. Okay, goodbye. And I'm grieving the whole time writing it, but I was grieving the whole time. I could see we were coming to a crashing end, not just because of addiction and people were going to die and I saw the machine. They came and stole everything. They fucking sucked up all of our magic. They started putting it into like digital programs. They started changing the way you buy music. I just watched it. I'm like, okay, well, fucked. Fucked. We just lost our human connection with each other. We just got bought, all of us. And not just, we were the sacrificial lambs, our generation's music moment. We're the last to gasp of like, no, we went down crying, and I am still crying. I'm fucking devastated. My 14-year-old daughter has to grow up in a world where you don't accidentally find your favorite band in front of 20 people and you can't even find them on the internet because there is no internet. That is so sad.
I feel like this still, and I say this as someone who's very much detached from it, and my kids won't let me go to punk shows anymore because my 13-year-old kid is just getting into punk and doesn't want me to ruin it for them. And I will totally respect that.
That's cool.
I think it still happens in this thing that we call punk. And I know you still debate whether or not you're part of it. I will maintain till my dying day that you are, but
Okay, great.
because this is a place where you can still go and have no talent and find a place and be in a shitty band like Anal Chinook and potentially be in Godspeed You Black Emperor, hopefully not the other path, but like there's this place where you can go and meet other kids that just want to do that, right? And
I mean,
that's
as long as you, yes, I have been talking obviously a lot to my 14-year-old daughter and her friends, but also to interviewers and women interviewers and different kind of sections of culture than you are, and saying that, my biggest mantra to, my anti-tech thing to young kids is you can't fall in love on a phone. And you cannot fall in love with a band on a phone. Yes, if you meet someone, fall in love, you can keep a connection and go to YouTube and see their live shows. You can like say, I love you on a text, of course, but it's not going to happen. The magic is not going to happen in the fake world, right? That it's technically proven that you can't feel oxytocin if you're not in a room with fucking humans and animals. We're animals. We're not like brains in a jar. So my biggest concern, because I run, absolutely, you can call it punk, I call it avant-garde art center in upstate New York that I started 15 years ago because I knew this shit was disappearing. And then COVID came and all the indie spaces are collapsing. We're the only cool independent, like, this shit is the infrastructure is going away. Yes, of course. I'm glad maybe because you're in Toronto that this is like, for people to have infrastructure, real estate and rents, everything is so the punk infrastructure of the heydays of especially somewhere like Montreal in the 80s and 90s or weird places in England, or LA, there was warehouses, there's fucked up stuff. Like you can't afford to be punk in the new world. So I debate, like, I think I'm happy your world has it, but I don't think it's given to kids as much as it should or could be because of all these problems of capitalism. They need it more than ever. They need it more than they've ever needed it. We thought we needed it in the 80s and 90s. They fucking need like temples of punk all over the planet, but like they can't afford the space. They can't afford to gather in person, you know, like, so where are they going to do it? Where's the movements going to happen other than online? I mean, I guess they have to resort to online real estate.
I've played some shows, and certainly there's been a lot of shows lately under bridges, jacking into power places. Like, that's the thing I think that's great about this. Like, yeah, like we're talking about a heyday.
You're also talking about Canada. Can you imagine Canada, America right now? The giant, biggest population of should be punks in the world. They can't even like walk down this, go to protests, let alone play a punk show. You know, they'll be considered a terrorist.
There's still stuff in East LA, like Latino hardcore bands in LA. Like, I feel like that's the thing about this music is like, it can adapt because it can be really shit and it can be really awesome. And that's the amazing thing about it. And it can give us great heroes and it can give us great villains.
Tragic because, heroes too.
Yeah. Like there's this sort of like, you know, like I think like your dad is obviously a great example of what bohemian intellectual freedom looks like. And you talk about some of the darker sides of this sort of thing growing up and the realities of growing up in it. And I think Gavin McGinnis is the ultimate reality of what happens when this sort of like free thinking shit can be taken to the extreme wrong place. And it's sort of this, I look at your dad and him as being very different, huge, fundamentally different politically, but like, it's almost like a yin and yang kind of contrast. And he's, I know Gavin's not from Montreal, but I feel like he's walking in your father's footsteps.
Interesting. Well, I'm hopeful you're right that free thinking is where it's at. And if it's a bridge or just like a garage, it can still happen. I also am speaking from, you know, a woman who's concerned about like neural pathways and addiction to tech. And then, you know, then they're just being fed the algorithm and then they don't get to find the cool punk algorithm. All of that stuff, I'm always sort of like, I'm on the lookout at all times of how can an alternative, sensitive, freaky soul find what they need and not just step into the obvious path that either their bad parents or their weird algorithm or the shitty internet is telling them to go on. That's my number one desire, is to protect people from a shitty path that somebody else dictates for them. And yeah, obviously, I guess that's where me and my father are cool and punk forever, is that I'm going to do what I want to do. I'm not going to do what people tell me to do. And I guess I'm afraid for the young people is that they're just going to be trapped in this like shitty consumer, you know, priorities. And they're just like being read and manipulated. And I mean, I know I trust, I always say to my daughter, cause she's like, you're so annoying. I'm like, I trust you. I trust you. You, I trust. It's these other, the things that I don't, it's like my father and the politicians. It's the same thing. It's like, I don't trust those assholes to raise you. Like I have to keep annoying you to tell you, I trust you, but there are scary things that are gonna, you know, try to convince you of weird, like that you should wear makeup and all that stuff. Anyway, whatever.
No, and you're 100% right. Like I've got three kids and I'm terrified for the world they kind of face. But what gives me hope is like, yeah, when I talk to my 13-year-old and I look at them and they don't give a shit about cool Nikes in the same way that I insecurely did, or they don't give a shit about like this sort of stuff. They're very post because they've grown up with this, right? Like in the same way you grew up around the wildness, so you were adapted to it when you joined Hole. I feel like hopefully this generation's grown up around this nightmarish hellscape in a way that they've adapted it and got resistance to it. And yeah, is my hope that like I wake up every day.
Yes, I think that everyone, I hope that for America as a nation, for example. So we can hope that people will wake up, that find their own way and question power, of course, and question greed that is trying to control you because they're power hungry. Yeah. What do we do if the time is up? How do I do this? What's your final big question?
Well, I'm not going to throw off the rest of your day. I'm going to try and keep you as on schedule as I possibly can. But I will end by saying, Melissa, if you ever want to come back on here and be convinced more that I think that you're a part of punk rock, you are always welcome. Please come back with our mutual friend, Patty Schmel. Patty, one of my favorite guests ever.
Yes.
Schmel. Sorry.
Yeah. Oh no. So yeah, that'd be, well, she would love to come on your
She's
show.
been
Has she
on.
done your
She's
show
one of the
many
greatest episodes
times?
ever.
Yeah, like she's super punk. That
Oh.
like Patty comes from like true like punk in the on the drums. Yeah, like I'm not trying to short sell myself. I just also am saying that I'm from another planet, punk. I'm an extraterrestrial, just letting you know at this very end of our conversation.